It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Even when you're not in your zone, when you're struggling with something, but if you're totally open and cool with that, if you accept that struggle, like if you can show it and you can include the audience in what you're struggling against and your own process of when I'm on stage and it's pouring rain and the wind is whipping, my hair is down my throat and the sound is terrible and I'm being electrocuted. If I'm just in that thing and sharing it fully with the audience, they could get off on even that.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. All right, special treat today, very, very personal introduction. All right, ready for this? I have spoken on the show before about Kate, my wife, life partner, love my life. She's amazing in a million different ways. She's been on with Pod twice. Kate and I met freshman year of college. And when I met Kate, she had a shaved head and she was really kind of intimidating intellectually because she's super brilliant and had really awesome and radical politics. And was in a period of life where she was like reading a lot of feminist theory that she was sort of sharing with me. And as one does when one is, you know, in love with a person and sort of early love, particularly, there was like a lot of music swapping. I was very into like a certain kind of sort of like boutique New York mixtape hip hop that I was constantly foisting upon her. And she was extremely into the brilliant singer-songwriter Ani DiFranco and sort of introduced me to Ani DiFranco. And I have these incredibly tender memories of like us listening to Ani DiFranco as we were, you know, kind of falling in love. And I have been a huge Ani DiFranco fan ever since, through these 2 decades since Kate and I met when we were 19. We're both over 40 now. And the thing that's really remarkable to me about Ani DiFranco, and this I think is true of the conversation I had with Anna Deavere Smith, is I'm really, really fascinated by people who have obvious, like, intense natural creative talent, but are able to take that natural creative talent and create and build a whole career out of it through kind of discipline and technique. And I'm really, really obsessed with technique in whatever, you know, whatever world it is exhibited in, whatever task it's exhibited in. I've been watching the Olympics and like finding it fascinating to like dig into the technique of swimmers or rugby players or volleyball. And technique around creativity is particularly interesting to me because creating things is so hard and so draining on the soul. And creating over a long period of time is really difficult. And Ani DiFranco is someone who has created an incredible body of work. She's a poet, writer. She had a New York Times bestselling book in 2019. She's written hundreds and hundreds of songs. She's toured. She has a record label. She's mentored other folks. She just had this incredible creative career. And I thought it would be such a treat and a delight for me personally, but I think also for you, the listeners, if I could get to talk to Ani DiFranco. And so today, that's what's happening. I'm very excited. Ani, it's great to have you on the program.
Hey, Chris. Hi. I love that intro.
Okay.
And so does the dog next door. Hopefully you
yeah,
don't
it's
mind
okay.
him
it's
joining
cool.
the conversation.
No, he'll be part of the convo. In fact, I think Kate wanted to pop in at some point, but she's picking up the kids from camp right now. So can I start with this? Can you tell me how you learned to play guitar and play music?
Wow. Let's see. I started by taking lessons when I was a kid. So I did learn to read music ever so briefly, and then I sort of did that for a few years, and then I put it all down. I don't know. I was moving on to other things. I guess maybe dancing. I got really interested in dancing and dedicated my kid time and energy there and put the guitar down. And then when I picked it back up as probably when I hit puberty and needed that guitar back, I had kind of forgotten how to read music and what I had learned maybe in those guitar lessons, but think there was just enough of it maybe subliminally back in the back of my brain to, I don't know, take it from there and really kind of play by ear from then on.
Did you have like a natural musical aptitude then that you recognize? Like, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, people can string a few chords together. I do that when I'm like at home playing music for my kids or whatever. But did you recognize something in yourself that took to it?
I definitely took to it. I mean, I felt it. Aptitude? I don't know. I guess maybe that's in the ear of the beholder. But I think I've come a long way. So maybe I had one part aptitude, but I think maybe even more significantly than that, I just had a huge love, lust for making music, for, like I talked about in my book, for coming up with a chord and then putting it next to another chord and ooh, and then putting it next to a different chord and seeing how that feels different. And then what if you go to that chord, or what if, you know, and it was an exploration for me and it was a journey of discovery. And I think I have learned a lot, way more on the journey than I sort of started out with. You know, in every way, just about melody, about harmony, about groove. I don't think I was like child prodigy. I think I was just so dedicated to my guitar. Once I really got down with it, I didn't want to put it down. You know, it was one of those relationships. Everything that I felt and needed to process got processed through my instrument and through my voice. And so I think in that way, I taught myself to be a musician more than I was born one, you know?
It's funny you say that, because I think there's increasingly a school of thought that says that, you know, our notions of natural talent and aptitude are pretty misplaced, and that really a lot of times what we're identifying is if someone is someone's passion and love. Like, people that get really good at stuff, like the getting good at it is because they love doing it, and so they're doing it all the time, and that turns them into being good at it, as opposed to there's some like special, you know, part of their DNA or some special light bulb that goes off. It's like you love doing it, so you do it a lot and then you get good at it.
Yep. I feel that, you know, and maybe that's not to say that there isn't a special ingredient in a person who goes far with something, but maybe the idea that that's special is what we could question. Like, actually those special ingredients are in all of us. They're all over the place. Any of us could manifest in so many different ways with all the X factors. Yeah. The opportunities, the support, the, you know, just the unencumbered space for your love and your passion to grow. Yeah et cetera. Totally.
One of my best friends in the world, actually a guy named Eddie Cooper, who wrote the music that we play on this podcast, he's a musician and a songwriter and has a band. And, you know, to me, like, if songwriting is a skill that like feels to me like someone who doesn't write songs and can't write songs as a superpower. It's like meeting someone who can fly. Like, I'm just like, oh my, wow. And I'm like this to Eddie all the time. For him, it's like, you just write songs. He's like, it's not that big a deal to him. To me, it really does feel like magic. What's different now about how you write songs than how you wrote them when you first were noodling around with chords? Like, what's changed over time?
I think, I gotta say, I've been writing songs, like you said, I've written hundreds for, I don't know, at least 30 years. And I think of it as kind of a superpower too. Like, that's my superpower. Damn it. That is it. That is, I got it.
It is. I think of, yes.
One.
It is a superpower.
Yeah. And, but you know, like any superhero, you know, there's a learning curve, you know, we don't all fly straight and high in the beginning. And I think, you know, I think a lot of things have changed along the way and changed back again and changed again. And, you know, but I think one thing that's kind of been developing is I'm less easily satisfied. So I hope that, you know, in one sense, like on one hand, sometimes I wish it got easier, you know, like why isn't it getting easier? Why isn't it automatic now after 30 years? Boop, there's a song. Boop, oh, perfect. Whoop, you know, it's almost like in some ways it gets harder. It gets harder because my standards get higher, and that's a good thing. And that's my hope. I mean, I know that that is as true as anything else. And I can look back at some of my older songs and see where I cut corners or got impatient, you know, and that kills me. And I just don't want to do that anymore. So I make sure now that I agree with myself with every word and every moment.
I think, you know, at some level, right, any creative process that is effortless is probably not really working. You know, that, I mean, hard things are hard to do, so, and doing things well is hard to do. I you know, I was just working on a piece of writing and I had a very stuck day writing and I was like, ugh, have I forgotten how to write? And then I was just sort of reminding myself that every good piece of writing I've ever done has felt hard at the time. And if it's not feeling hard, then there's something kind of missing, I think, a little bit.
Well, yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, I would hope for all of us creatives, or I mean, I guess every human is creating something, you know, that we should be gifted moments where it's effortless, you know, or where it feels that way, where we don't have to try so hard and we can just soar. But then when that moment is done, there comes the next moment. And then sometimes you have to look at what you did or think or scrutinize it or improve upon, question yourself or move on to the next level of doing what you do, where you're not going to be soaring for a while or you're going to just be sore. Or, you know, it's, I think that like a moment of effortlessness is not necessarily an indication that you're coasting or that you're shirking your responsibility to grow. It might just be one of those beautiful moments that you've earned, but it won't last.
You started performing very early. Did you immediately like performing, or did it take some overcoming to feel comfortable in front of people?
I would say door number two more. I mean, I think I immediately needed it. I mean, I think my need to connect with people, which I whatever found this context of performing music in order to reach out and touch people and feel them and feel them feel me and feel seen and feel connected to people. And that's what I really needed. So I was searching for that through performing music. The being on display part, the being on stage part, the performing part of performing was hard, and I sucked. I super sucked in for a while, like a while. And people, you know, it's not just whatever, my humility. I wasn't a natural extrovert or hambone or confident. And people did reflect back to me in the early days, either literally verbally or just with their energy, like, will you stop? I was very self-deprecating. That was the way I dealt with feeling so insecure. I would just put myself down. And that's a horrible thing to keep foisting on an audience. It just makes them want to like, oh, you just, I just stop, just stop, just stop. So
it's so true. It's, I mean, there are ways, it's funny. Self-deprecation works with audiences if it's coming from a person who's actually supremely confident. Because then
you
it feels exactly
with them.
Yes. Then they're laughing with them and they're in control. But if it comes from a person who is actually not confident, it's extremely difficult to be in the presence
of. It is the opposite of what we search for in our performers. We want to see somebody free. We want to see somebody who doesn't give a, who is just in their body and in the moment and doesn't care what people think.
And in control. I mean, that's what, that's such a huge part of that relationship between performer and audience is the joy and the thrill of watching someone in total control.
Yeah.
And because that's liberating for the audience, because then, because we spend so much of our lives, you know, figuring out what we're doing in our own neuroses. And so when you're in the presence of someone, it's like you're being liberated by their confidence and presence.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I would add to that, because I don't always feel in control or in my zone when I'm on stage, unfortunately. I wish I could say that I was, but I have heard also reflected back from people that just, even when you're not in your zone, when you're struggling with something, but if you're totally open and cool with that, if you accept that struggle,
yes.
Like if you can show it and you can include the audience in what you're struggling against and your own process of when I'm on stage and it's pouring rain and the wind is whipping, my hair is down my throat and the sound is terrible and I'm being electrocuted. If I'm just in that thing and sharing it fully with the audience, they could get off on even that.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you, so I just want to make a disclaimer here. I might ask you some personal questions, which you obviously don't have to answer if they're too personal, A, and B, some questions that might seem like preposterously banal, but I'm curious. And
nothing's off limits with me.
Okay. So on the second part, so like I was thinking about our conversation today and I was like, what does Ani DeFranco's workday look like? Like, how do you structure what you're doing and how do you structure the time to write songs? And is it, you know, there's a certain time, or is it when the spirit moves you? Like, what does your day look like as Ani DeFranco?
Yeah, that's a question I've actually, it's funny you should ask, because I've been asking myself that question lately, because I've just moved into a new space with my family and a new house. And there's this shack on the other side of the property that is mommy's workspace, right? Okay, great. This is what the plan all along. That will be my space. And I'm just, as we've now moved in, I'm realizing, wait, I can't, you know, this shack, that can't be my only workspace. I have to get, wait, what do I really do? I was thinking of myself 20, 30 years ago. What I do is I sit and I feel my feels and I write songs. That, unfortunately, I am 50 now, and that's like 5% of what I do, you know? And so I've been having to get real. I need an office. It needs to be connected to the studio, to the rest of the house with everything in it, with the mailing supplies and the thing in my, and the hard drive with the thing on and the thing in the computer and the laptop and the thing and the other strings for the thing. And the idea that I could do my daily office job, part of being Ani, out in the shack is not tenable. And I'm realizing, you know, like, right, okay, so I guess
just
the majority,
just a room and a guitar.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And like a loaf of bread or something and a bottle of wine. No, that is, I wish I could say that was my songwriter existence, but the songwriter rarely gets to get on her horse and ride around at all anymore. In fact, I'll tell you what, on tour is when I mostly get creative time. There's a lot of downtime on the road between sound checking and interviewing and gigging. So that is when I can play guitar now. When I'm home, a day in the life is overwhelmed by children, by momming, by all of that. And then there's, of course, the emails. There's all the side hustles that I'm trying to diversify my income with, especially post-pandemic, when my touring income ground to a very sharp halt. And it was a very big deal for my operation because I'm the breadwinner. You know, these days, a day in the life involves working on a children's book. It involves working on a musical. It involves all kinds of associations with other musicians and their records and their projects and their books and their, you know, so it's like many people's, a constant deluge of emails and writing and thinking and developing projects.
So you just said something that I've read in other interviews in the pandemic, and I wanted to ask you about. So I'm glad you brought it up, which is I came across an interview you were talking about touring income. And, you know, that's how you make money. It's a big part of how you support your family. And obviously in the pandemic that dried up. And I had this weird thought of like, oh, right. Like it just didn't never occur to me. Like, well, how does Ani DiFranco make money? Like what, you know, what I think you exist in my head as this presence outside of the, like the banal realm of like, you know, of electricity bills. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
And it connected to something else that I think about a lot, which is just like what the economics of music are like now. I mean, obviously they've changed so radically. My sense from the musicians I know in my life is that touring really has become kind of the main lifeblood of a lot of musicians, if not most. And I got to imagine that the pandemic was just brutal for that.
Yeah. Big shock to the system. You know, I mean, I have been blessed with a live audience that's still there for me to go and play to after all these years. And so I keep doing it and I keep loving it. But I am getting a little exhausted of the travel aspect, you know, that I need to go travel, physically drive town to town to sing for my supper. And I think most of that has to do with being a mom. You know, it's so hard to come and go from my kids and keep the stability, keep the bond, keep the vibe, keep the flow going. It's very disruptive. And so I was already on the tip of trying to devise a way that the bread and butter can come not all from playing shows. And then, of course, the pandemic was like, surprise, figure it out yesterday, you know? So, it's in one sense, it's a great blessing to have an audience and be able to go and be a working musician and no complaints, you know, of all the jobs that one could have in this world. I am so grateful. But it's also become hard over the years, you know? And so, yeah, I'm like trying to diversify how Ani pays the bills. It's been really challenging. In one sense, it's like, I almost think, geez, I'll just go get on another plane, because at my age to reinvent it all, to get right back to the hustle is also exhausting. But, you know, that's life. And I think we all have been challenged by this pandemic.
Yeah. What you just said about travel, I mean, I am not a traveling musician, but, you know, in different phases of my life, I've had to travel a fair amount. Campaigns years tend to be pretty brutal for that. And I found with young kids, the older I've gotten, just, you know, there's used to be part of travel that felt, you know, work travel felt like kind of fun. And sometimes would take you places you haven't been. And there was like a little bit of a thrill of being in a hotel, and maybe I would like order some room service or like, and just all of that has just completely curdled for me. And I don't enjoy any of it. And I don't like being away from my family and my kids, really very much at all. So I can imagine that, you know, that it's just, it's a lot harder to do that when you got little ones at home.
Yes. I feel exactly as you just expressed, you know, and I imagine that without kids, I could keep that romance going more. I could go to I could still find a new place, or I could still find a thrill in being on the lam, and I could still, but the pull of, I mean, for me, definitely having this last year where I kept my plants alive, I didn't have to come home to my dead beloved plants, and I kept my relationship with my kids alive, and I was here for every dinner, and it just, there's nothing worth that, even the best job.
Yeah, that's it. I had a very similar realization, because I just have seen my kids more in the last 18 months than I had for the previous 7 years working on the job, mostly because I miss dinner every night, so I come home after they're in bed. And it really changes things.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
You left home really early, like sort of shockingly early, at 15, is that right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, my parents had split. I was living with my mom, and she in Buffalo, where I grew up, and she took a job in Connecticut and decided she was just going to reinvent her life in a very different place. And this was an area of Connecticut. It was sort of rural, small town-ish. It was not where I wanted to be. So I stayed behind. So that was, I couldn't see myself moving in with my father and brother for reasons I won't go into. And I couldn't see myself moving to rural Connecticut with my mother. So at 15, you know, I was already playing music. I had a band. I had gigs. I had a life. I had a job. So I stayed and I just made a go of it at that point. And my mother, you know, I was already very self-sufficient. So the situation was just accepted by her.
I mean, 15 is young.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a weird journey up till then. Definitely an unconventional childhood. When I was 9, my brother went to a hospital in Boston. Again, we were living in Buffalo. So, and this hospital required my parents to be there twice a week for meetings and to be a part of his healing. So they actually, for a good spell, like when I was 9, 10, 11, before they split up, they were gone. Most of the week. So I went from being a latchkey kid that came home and let myself in because I had two working parents to kind of being alone in my house. I mean, I stayed with friends mostly when they were gone during the week. But so there was already a trajectory towards self-sufficiency for me. So yeah, it was weird.
I wonder how does that impact your perspective now on that you're a parent, a mom?
Well, it's mind-blowing for sure because I have a 14-year-old daughter who can't use the toaster by herself, you know? So I don't know what happened in one generation that we should go from one extreme to the other.
I literally had this conversation with peer parents in which we were literally saying this, that like, it feels like I remember I'm a little younger than you, but not a ton. I mean, sort of similar cohort. And, you know, I remember going to kids' houses when we were like 7 or 8, they let themselves in with their keys. We would like climb up on the counter to get the snacks. Mm-hmm. No one's like, parents were around ever.
Yep.
And that I think was like a bit much. That seemed like a little on the low touch end. And then now I feel like it is the opposite. It's just like complete high touch, almost kind of cosseted expectations of presence of parents in kids' lives. And I totally agree that it has really swung a lot in those generational shifts.
Yeah, that is wild, isn't it? And I mean, as a parent, I have to say, my instinct is not to be a helicopter. I'm the type that, let them walk on the wall and they'll fall. Right. They're not going to die. It's only 5 feet up, right? They might hurt themselves, and you got to learn to cut with a knife and you got to learn to use the scissors and you got to learn to, you know, just, and I think I very instinctually and or intentionally, you know, go, yeah, I'm not going to entertain you all the time. Go figure it out, you know, and go out of my sight. And so I'm not the super helicopter parent. And yet here I have a kid who's much younger at 14 than I. And yeah, it's mind-blowing to me. And I mean, I have to look around, I guess, at the whole world and see how radically it has changed. Like, I've moved into the neighborhood of my kid's school. So these kids are going to start walking to school about five blocks, you know, which I'm thrilled about and I think will breed independence. And, you know, but it's not the world of when we were kids walking to school. This is not an entirely safe neighborhood. There are incidents, there is violence, there's guns everywhere. There's not a fabric of community with eyes on your kids for that whole five blocks. Mm. So that's a different equation than when we were young, you know? So it's a different, what looks like the identical circumstance is inherently different. So I don't know.
I'm curious your sort of political formation too at that time, because I feel like, you know, you were very young. You at 15, you know, you decided to stay in Buffalo. You end up going down to New York City. You're performing, and very early on have, you know, a very clear set of political commitments, principles. Did those come from your parents at all? How did those develop?
Definitely, yeah. I did not arrive upon my wokeness on my own, to whatever degree I am awake. My parents were, they were old school in some sense. They were older, literally. My mom was 50 and my dad 60-ish when I was born, you know? So, 40 and 50. But which was unheard of at that time, 50 right. years ago, you know, like everybody thought they were my grandparents. So in one sense, they were old, but in another sense, very forward thinkers. Bless them. Holy cow. Were they progressive? Even, you know, the Italian immigrant that was my father. And then my mother is basically a Canadian immigrant. But they were just aware people, very progressive, very engaged, especially my mother, very engaged. And I think just gave me a bedrock for understanding my citizenship, for understanding that I was part of something bigger and that there was work to be done, that there was something to be accountable to that was bigger than me. There was a society, there was a nation, there was a community, a culture, and this was all very real to me from the beginning.
What was your relationship like with them as you got older?
They were very supportive, you know, and like as we were saying, like very, you know, it was beyond leniency. Like very early on, they weren't granting me permission to be me, to live, to do my thing. It was just happening. So in that sense, you know, that was a form of support, of just like, you do you, you got it, I trust you. You know, that is a big thing to communicate to a kid, and they did that. So that, you know, that carried through. Even as I probably in my late teens, in my 20s, sometimes worried them from afar, I'm sure, you know, but they never tried to clamp down. They never tried to, you know, take control at any point or tell me how to do my life. They just remained supportive from afar. So it was always, you know, and sometimes that literally, blessedly translated into money. Like I would go visit my mom and she'd always hand me some cash before I left, you know, just like without saying anything, without making a deal, without shaming me or making me feel like I owed her one, just like, here, kid, you know. So it was, the relationship was always pretty, pretty great.
When you were, you know, a sort of independent kind of folk singer-songwriter, starting 18, 19, 20. You know, there was a sense, I think, that your politics were sort of completely antithetical to, you know, the establishment, for lack of a better word. And
the me generation.
Yeah, totally.
The 80s, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's a sort of, I'm really curious how you think about the arc of the kind of politics that you've held for your life over the last 20 years, where there's a strange thing in which in some ways it feels like they've become much more mainstream. There's other ways in which, like, you know, they've also feel like they're kind of co-opted sometimes. Like, you can imagine, like, Raytheon tweeting an Ani DeFranco song or something, you know, like, like, or like, you know, Boeing is like, you know, they've got their tweet about whatever LGBT pride, or like there's ways in which the kind of strongly kind of anti-commercial, you know, anti-capitalist and left radical vision that has animated mm-hmm. you was so sort of outside the mainstream, and parts of it have kind of been brought into in ways that I think are, represent progress, but also kind of troubling. I don't know. I'm sort of mm-hmm. having a hard time articulating this, but mm-hmm. it was something that I wanted to talk to you about because you've watched the arc of this over the last several decades.
I think you're doing a fine job of speaking to it, sir. And I agree. But I guess my perspective would be that I will take the degree of co-optation for the ever-expanding, you know, embracing
yes.
of diversity, for the ever-expanding awareness of diverse realities and lives and existences and perspectives. I mean, I never could have imagined at age 18, 20, that the words white supremacy, or for instance, would be spoken on the TV.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Right. It's so great. I mean, the fact that, let alone gender diversity or, you know, whatever it is, you know, I hope we get to the word patriarchy soon.
Right.
And I can't believe that the things that me and the crazies or the sideline, the marginalized peoples have been talking about all along are beginning to enter the dominant discourse. Mm-hmm. I just think it's incredible. I just am so, you know, and people, you know, and we should talk about these things, the tension between you know, the blossoming of it in the culture and the co-optation of yeah. it, you know, and really try to stay vigilant, and not just be a soundbite, but really get behind the ideas behind these words and really bring those out as well. You know, but people, you know, when they say, what do you think about Beyonce flashing feminist behind her? I mean, you know, like sort of, which I'm not saying is what you were doing, right. but fishing for some level of criticism, you know, is that really feminist? Should it, is that just, no, for me, the idea that Beyonce would identify as a feminist hugely publicly in lights is so great.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. And whatever degree of suspicion we're going to have along the way that people are, that there's lip service happening here or there, or they're not following through, is nothing compared to even maybe the first step of collectively embracing the language,
yeah.
the language of change. Before we can, if we can't say the words, we can't embody the concept. So if we start by saying these words together, we're on the path.
I think that's an extremely wise way of looking at it. And is, I mean, partly I bias because I think that's my sort of way of looking at it too. But I also think, I think there is something interesting, which is that I think part of this grew out of the politics of punk to a certain amount. But I think in the late 80s and 90s particularly, there was real fixations on authenticity and and selling out and versus not selling out, which I feel like was one generations ago version of some of the kind of factional disputes about who is on what side of which line ideologically. Mm-hmm. That was our version, it was and I do think that has bled out a little bit in a sort of useful way. But I think I do think this is clear in your most recent album, Revolutionary Love, and you've said it in other interviews about just, trying to be both, the difficult squaring of the circle that comes from being principled and righteous and militant in what you believe in, and also not being a judgmental who is alienating and constantly finding ways to cut people out as opposed to bring them in.
Yep. Yeah. Wow. It's funny. You're asking, I don't know. I love what you're bringing up. It's a lot about, it's connected, I feel like, to things I've been thinking about lately. I had a conversation where I was trying to build a bridge. I was trying to build a bridge of understanding between two very disparate perspectives. And I was very strategic in what I expressed, in how I expressed it. I spent the rest of the day reeling because I suppressed my urge to get angry, to go on the attack, to point the finger, even though I felt outraged at a lot of moments. And I felt the residual, just outrage. And I spent the day questioning, what is it to be, this business of authentic versus strategic? And how do you find that balance? Because just screaming, how could you? You should be ashamed, is not going to get us where we need to be together, right? So, it was incredibly humbling. But, my poet's brain, when life gets really hard for me in these moments of trying to communicate in effective or useful ways, and utilize my outrage without having it overwhelm the situation or thwart the bridge being built, my brain leans towards metaphor, towards analogy, and I try to see everything as an exercise of living and feeling and understanding beyond myself. I just thought about, maybe this is a little inkling of what it might be to be Black in America, for instance, to be subject to an assumed authority, that an assumed power that has legit power over you that you have to, you have to engage with. But are they really more powerful?
Right.
Is their authority legitimate? The humility it takes to engage with that power and to try in every moment to not let your outrage, hit the face of that other person so that they can, and to do everything you can to be heard, to be seen. The humility, that was what I was trying to access. And I think those are great exercises for me, Ani. This is the work you need to do, to more deeply understand what it is like to have to answer to someone. I've led an incredibly free, incredibly privileged life, but like most of us, I am not totally free. I am not totally, I do have to answer to certain things, to certain forces, to certain people. And those are our workshops. You know, it often starts with our families, right?
Well, it's funny you say that because a Dylan line I always quote. I quote, I'm sure Tiffany, who's listening and well, because I've quoted it in editorial meetings, is that, you know, you're going to have to serve somebody. It's going to, it may be the devil or maybe the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. And, you know, that's a real lesson of adult life, is that no matter what you think about freedom, there's no such thing in any pure sense, because there's going to be obligations and dependencies and you're going to have to negotiate them. And it's going to be that's just an unavoidable part of being a human being.
Yep.
And sometimes those can get, I think particularly if you're like a creatively minded and independent person, can be really tough to deal with.
Yeah. But I do hope that, you know, I'm getting closer to my humility every day. You know, I feel that way. And I hope that I can bring more of it into my songs, you know, and which is not to say that my youthful frickin' rage was not also very good, useful, powerful energy. And I think youthful, that when you're so sure of yourself and you have something to say and you want to say it so loudly, and that's essential for change in our society. But I think as now that I'm getting older, I have new ingredients to work with, and I don't have as much of the old ingredients. And so I'm hoping that, you know, I think you can hear it on my new record that, you know, I'm trying to make sure I'm singing from the same level as anybody who might choose to listen. I'm not putting myself above. I want to be open. I want to stay open to everybody. That's the sort of revolutionary love that I'm questing for.
You're working on a children's book?
I am.
That sounds fun.
It is. It's I'm not going to draw this book, which I was disappointed by.
Did someone have to break that news to you?
Yes, he did. My publisher came along and said, "We're gonna, you know, again, I've been working on all these side hustles," and they're like, "Okay, yeah, we'll get behind your book. Here's a little advance, but we're gonna get a professional illustrator, okay?" And I was like, But I did have fun writing the words, and I actually wrote a song that is going to also be a book. I was trying to just make a book, and then, it just ended up, the task was to make a lullaby book, and so I literally made a lullaby. But I think I'm pretty pleased with, I think it really works as a book and a song. So I'm excited.
I think every parent has the, you know, when you become a parent, you start discovering, you know, really rediscovering children's books, obviously. You're reading them to your kids. Mm-hmm. And you get really into the ones that you love. And you also find that, like, I found that with kids' books, A, there's a huge variety. Like, some are great and some are really not. And then there's also a crazy stickiness where, like, there'll be a book, like, my favorite example of this is Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, which is like this very simple, silly conceit that like is just wildly sticky with my kids. Like, they all loved it. They all wanted to read it a million times. There's a kind of magic that's a little like songwriting.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
Like a song can be really simple and just stick and not even be like, could be a simple three chord song, like a million other three chord songs written before it, but stick. And like kids' books are the same way. It's like some kind of alchemy that makes a great kids' book versus a not great kids' book, but it's unclear sometimes what it is. But then you show it to kids and it's like, whoa, they like Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus. It's just a great kids' book. I don't know why.
Yeah. For reals. I know. I don't think I understand that alchemy any more than you do, pal. But so it's fascinating. It's challenging. I don't know if I'll make something that connects, but yeah, I mean, Mo Willems, Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus. He's got it.
He does.
He's the rock star.
Yes, correct.
Not since Dr. Seuss have we been so.
He's got it. I don't know what it is.
He's got it. Yeah, and it really, Yeah, and like you say, it's, you don't need a lot of words. You don't need sophisticated concepts to tap into something so deep. You know, I just kissed my baby. I feel like a king. Because, you know, and it's like you could just, you're in that moment, you know, with the, I'm jumping. Yes. But, you know, it's just like, there's a way that you can say it and deliver it that connects. And he's got it for reals. We'll see. We'll see what if I have any feel for the kids' book oeuvre.
So do you see yourself, is music, playing music and writing songs something you just think that will be a part of your life no matter what stage of your life you're in?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I really do. I really, yes, I think so. You know, as long as the universe allows it, like even as overwhelmed as I've been lately and just bogged down in the grind and the multitasking, you know, like I'll stop and I'll get the faraway look and I'll like type into my phone an idea that came to me and I get so excited. I get so excited still by the possibility of making that idea into a song, of building on it, of, you know, I just felt it the other day. And so I know that, and like you said, I too am like getting more and more off on having a craft that I've honed for 30 years. And it's, and to be able to do that thing that you've practiced so much and failed at so much and grown through so much it's still thrilling.
Ani DeFranco is a Grammy award-winning musician, singer-songwriter, founder of Righteous Babe Records' newest album, released in January, is Revolutionary Love, author of No Walls and Recurring Dream, which was released in 2019. It's a New York Times bestseller, and author of a forthcoming children's book, which we'll see. We'll see if it's any good. Just never know.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Once again, huge, huge, huge thanks to Ani DeFranco. That was really a trip. That was really, really cool. I tried to keep it together. I think I did a pretty good job. You can tweet us with the hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com.
Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by Donnie Holloway, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.